Welcome to the fourth episode of Classicists in Transition, a podcast by the Ghent Institute for Classical Studies, aimed at fostering a larger sense of community among the various researchers active in classics at Ghent University. We are Dimitri and Alison, and today we talk with Bram Fauconnier on the theme of education. Today we welcome Bram Fauconnier to our podcast series. Bram is an ancient historian. He is linked with the Department of Ancient History at Ghent University, where he works in a postdoctoral project led by Professor Lieve van Hoof. Bram has a PhD in history, but is also been a teacher at several secondary schools in Belgium. Welcome, Bram.
Hello, good afternoon.
So maybe you can tell us a little bit about your journey to where you are today, maybe how you got into ancient history, sort of your path to how you got to be a postdoctoral researcher here at Ghent.
All right. It's been a long and windy route. So I graduated in 2010. And since then, my professional life has always been at the crossroads of two distinct elements, namely education and research. These are really two passions for me, and I have been able to pursue them both. So after graduating, I did a teacher training program, then I traveled to India to study. Then I also worked in a museum at the educational department. I worked in secondary schools, and then I had the opportunity to become teaching assistant at the KU Leuven, which I combined with working in a secondary school. And after that, I started my PhD research in Germany and in the Netherlands, which I finished in 2017, defending my PhD in 2018. And after that, I worked for 2 years in several secondary schools. And in 2019, finally, I could start my postdoc project. So I've been going back and forth between education and research.
Yeah, when you talk about that track record, that long way inside and outside academia, could you describe a little bit how you feel with that kind of pathway in your professional career? Is that I can imagine it came with both positive and negative obstacles, decisions you had to take on the road where you wanted to go with your research. Can you highlight a little bit of the mental pathway that accompanied you during this research?
Sure. Yeah. On the one hand, I'm really happy with the opportunities I had. I'm happy that I could pursue over 10 years like these two passions, and that I could develop myself in these two branches, and that I could also contribute to both research and to the education of young people, which is really satisfying. But on the other hand, I often had my doubts. I still do not really know which should be my main direction. So I'm trying to live in the present a lot and see what happens next. Maybe I can continue my academic career. Maybe I will go back to secondary education. I don't know yet. We'll see. But over the past few years, especially at the time of transition when I went after my PhD research back to secondary schools, yeah, there were a lot of doubts. I thought maybe I'm mainly a researcher and I'm not a good teacher at all. But then after a few months, I became accustomed to being a teacher and I saw that I had an impact on these children, and I drew a lot of satisfaction from this teaching. And so then I felt at home in secondary school, and then I had an opportunity to go back to university. And then I saw, hey, I really missed research too. This is also something I like. So yeah, I think it's a bit Jekyll and Hyde. I have two natures combined in my mind.
And do you find that teaching at the secondary level do you get a different sort of sense of satisfaction, or is that a really different experience for you? As opposed to teaching at the university level, because I know that you've been teaching quite a bit at Ghent University, and also you're involved in this new program at Ghent. the study owes, or like the sort of the mentorship with the first year. So do you maybe see that that the university level teaching is really different than secondary, or can you get the same sense of impact?
Yeah, there are of course a lot of differences, because at university you've got much more motivated people. Discipline is no problem in general. And you can go deeper at university. You can, the level is higher, of course. So secondary education poses different challenges, but they are charming in their own rights. Sometimes it can be really frustrating when you got dispirited and disinterested pupils in front of you. But I think it's also a challenge to make them passionate about history. So it's a different game, but at the same time, you use similar strategies. It's the same passion that drives me, whether I stand before students at university or in a secondary school. When I lose myself in my story, in my subject, it's the same thing that drives me. And but of course, the little strategies of motivating and the contents are different, of course.
Yeah, yeah. You strike me as a very enthusiastic person, as someone that's very motivated in bringing the field of classics or the subject of classic towards lots of different audiences and a lot of different wider younger groups also. I can imagine that sometimes the reverse reaction of the outside world, of the world outside academia, can sometimes be perhaps less enthusiastic, or how would you describe the position sometimes of people you encounter in your educational efforts, for example, or in your communication to a wider audience? Are they always as positive or enthusiastic about the field as classics, the relevance of classics in today in our society?
Yeah, so my answer won't be limited to classics. So I taught history in secondary schools, so also different time periods. So my answer will concern history, I think, as a whole. The problem is, I think that classical or humanistic education is threatened by two things. First, it's a kind of utilitarian thinking that everything should have immediate short-term economic value. And all courses, they have to or feel the need to legitimize themselves, showing what they contribute on this short term, what they contribute for the economic gain of society. And second, the second threat is kind of digitalism, that as long as if it's digital or on the internet, it's good. I won't deny that technology, the digital technology, has allowed us to do much more than we could in the past. But I think it's become a kind of religion. So history and classics always have to legitimize themselves concerning this utilitarianism and digitalism. And it's hard because there is no immediate economic gain. I think the value of history and classics lies in other aspects to which we can return later. But yes, so this need to legitimize yourself, it can be tiring, and we have to do it again and again and again. And especially pupils, they ask quite a lot. Yeah, why do we have to study this? Why do we have to do this? And then I always try to spend some time in explaining why it is indeed valuable to be engaged with history and classics.
And so what are sort of how do you sort of sell history to your pupils? Just out of curiosity, because I think it's something that everyone, especially, all historians, but maybe especially those of the ancient world, have to sort of grapple with. So what are some of the ways that you explain to your pupils that, it is valuable to spend time thinking about the past?
Yeah. So I always compare society to a person. I would say, let's imagine that you don't remember what happened in your past, except for what happened in the last few weeks. So how would you interact with your world? And then they would come to see that they would be handicapped, severely handicapped. And then they often start to see that it's important for a society to know where it comes from, to know its past, its cultural heritage. I also explain that knowing your history makes you a bit more free. It shows that what we take for granted nowadays, it often only happens because of a chain of circumstances and events, and that things could be different, and that you are not forced to live that way, that in the past people could have made other decisions, and that they are also quite free to do it differently. I read that in this book of Yuval Noah Harari, which is quite popular, history, but I think there are some interesting thoughts in it. He says, yes, look at just having, I don't know the word, grass in front of your house. This is just a fashion which only came into being like a few hundred years ago in aristocratic circles, and it became a means to show wealth and the possibility to have such a lot of grass and to spend a lot of time in taking care of this. So it became a kind of status thing. And he shows, and yeah, it could be different. You don't have to own a lot of grass in order to show your status. You could opt for a Japanese rock garden, for instance. So it's a stupid example, but it makes clear that choices often depend on what happened in the past, and that we become more free by seeing that.
Yeah, I think that's a very important point, that the one you stress about giving people insight into the value of intellectual freedom, the freedom to make your own choices and to become very aware of the fact that indeed the society of today is not society of the past, and the things we do now, it is not necessary to do always the same kind of things, and that there are really a big range of possibilities. And that connects quite well with the idea of, I think, academic freedom as well, because the academic discipline is unique in several ways, but also in the way that you quite have a lot of freedom, not only in your work, but also in your personal life. How do you work with that kind of academic freedom, not only now, but perhaps also in the past when you were working abroad, when you were studying for your PhD in different universities, in different countries? I can imagine that kind of freedom comes with both lots of possibilities, but also responsibilities and perhaps some difficulties as well. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, I think that's a major advantage of being in academia, this freedom. I value it a lot, but indeed, it comes with big responsibilities. And I think structure here is essential. By nature, I'm a quite chaotic person. So I really need this structure to get to work, to make good plannings. Now I think it's even more difficult in these corona times. Working at home in lockdown, it makes planning and a schedule even more important. Because I feel that working at home, I lose a bit of the familiar structure I need to work. So going to the library is more difficult than before. So yeah, I need to get organized better. But still, I find it challenging indeed to work and concentrate in these lockdown times.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I wonder if you feel the same way, because for a very short period, I worked in a school, and yeah, it was sort of in a way that was really great because there was so much structure. You know, you had to teach at this time, you had to get all your work done, and this is when you had lunch, this is when there was a break. And it was in a way almost freeing that there was a structure. But I was also always like sort of yearning for that just freedom to make my own structure. There's always this tension between too much time and not enough time, and I think you're right, the corona situation just makes it so much worse.
I recognize that, absolutely.
I wonder if you can maybe speak a little bit about all of your international experiences, because you mentioned that, okay, you're a researcher in Belgium and you did your first degrees in Belgium, but you also pursued your PhD in the Netherlands and Germany, and I think you also went even further afield for one of your degrees to India. So I wonder if you can say something about maybe what you gained from all these experiences, maybe in terms of different educational approaches or approaches to history or classics that you've sort of experienced in all these different countries.
Yeah, to start with my Indian experience, I indeed went there, did the first year of an MPhil program. I went on my own initiative out of curiosity. So I enrolled at the University of Delhi, capital of India, out of sheer curiosity. I had been in India before as a tourist, and I was so fascinated by this strange and paradoxical country that I wanted to indulge in it, to dive deeper into this and to discover more about it. So I lived 1 year in India. And so, yeah, meeting a completely different culture was very enriching. It really changed my perspective on the world. I broke a bit free from the rather small world I knew, and saw that so many millions of people live in different circumstances, often more difficult circumstances. So yes, I learned quite a lot from that. Also on the educational level, because in India there are still many what they call scheduled castes, so backward castes, which are often being discriminated against. And so the government has a positive discrimination program in which these people can get fixed places at the university or in government institutions. And so this was also the case in my study group. So there were several people from these lower caste backgrounds. And I saw the big value of this positive discrimination, because it enabled them to break free from poverty, to have decent jobs. These programs can lift entire families out of poverty. But on the other hand, it is undeniable that it lowers the quality of education, because often these people went to secondary schools funded by the state rather than private English schools. So they call it Hindi medium schools as opposed to English private schools. And so the quality is undeniably lower. Many of these people couldn't really understand an academic English article. And this was in a research year. So this indeed lowered the quality of education. Although I learned so many things there from the professors, the discussions were hampered by this. So I saw both the negative and positive aspects of this totally different socioeconomic situation there. And I learned quite a lot from that.
Yeah, I can imagine that I've only been in India for tourism for a while, for a couple of weeks. But indeed, that country has such a profound impact on you as a person, because you see those gigantic differences in society between modern West society and the society in India. That is really quite amazing. And I can imagine that it not only have had an impact on you as a person, perhaps also in your work. In the sense, we were talking earlier before the interview on your research project on Roman elite societies in Asia Minor. And I wonder if some of your insights into how elite versus poorer members of society in countries such as India has influenced your views on Asian society, for example.
I think we in any case have to be careful in drawing like explicit comparisons, but still, going there made me, I think, more aware of how power works, or more interested in how power works. And in India, Indian research is really interested in subjects like decolonization. And in these studies, power plays a really important role. And although I'm not involved myself in decolonization studies or colonial studies, I'm really interested in this power aspect, how power works, how power is connected to socioeconomic inequality. And I think this also has an influence on how I come back to my own research. Yes.
Sort of a different question, just thinking about the different ways that you engage with teaching about history and classics and engaging with a wider audience and how you communicate. I remember one of the times we first met, you talked about this activity you do usually in the summers, where you put on productions to communicate history. So I wonder if you'll indulge us and talk a little bit about that that aspect of your history communication.
Oh yes, I'm a member of a medieval show group. We are not exactly a reenactment group, but we do dress like medieval knights and we stage medieval tournaments, but the focus lies on the show element. So you could consider us as a kind of show theater in a medieval setting. And of course, knights and the Middle Ages are very popular with a really young audience, but I think many people still remain young in their hearts, just like me, and are still interested in this world of knights, even if it's more a kind of romantic fantasy world of knights. But still, it's a way of communicating history to a broader public and to make people enthusiastic about history, because there is this show fantasy element in it, of course, but we try to communicate too about the historical aspects of these knights and explaining how they were dressed. Like, we try to be historically correct in our outfits and armor and weapons. And we also explain about these weapons and armor and about the life of knights. So I think we managed to make both young people, children, and adults enthusiastic about the Middle Ages, inviting them to look up more about it. So in these tournaments and shows, I can bring together both my passion for history, my own, the little kid in me that never really disappeared, and my love to communicate and make people passionate about history.
Yeah, that's so great. Because I think that especially, you know, as academics doing all this research all the time, and we've talked about this in earlier podcasts, you know, it is things like this that get a lot of people interested in history in the first place. I just wanted to hear a little bit more about that.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting to hear that sense of blending ancient and modern and medieval societies together, to not make that big distinction between those different kinds of societies, but just let people also understand that our world is just an evolving world, and that we're going from perhaps from one what we call society to another, but in a way we have different interpretations of how people communicate and live with each other. So I was wondering how we mentioned your work on Roman elites, and I was wondering how, if you could tell us a little bit about how this kind of cyclic aspect of how society works, how this relates to what you're doing with your work on Roman elites, and perhaps also tell us a little bit of what precisely the research project is that you're involved with now.
So what I'm researching is are actually power struggles among the elites in Roman Asia Minor in the first centuries AD, and the strategies they used to gain an advantage in these struggles, to overcome their opponents, and also how they made links with the Roman government and how they exploited these links. So it's a kind of, I wouldn't really say bottom-up approach, because I still focus on the elite, but it starts from like the provincial elites rather than from a major theory about how the Roman Empire was governed. So it starts from the people at the lower tier. Is it cyclical? Yes, always. When I study these elites, I always compare in my mind with later stages in history. I try to compare them to, for instance, the medieval period and how elites in the Roman Empire differed from the elites in a feudal society. So I haven't really made a historical comparison or a study, but it's always in the back of my mind as a kind of reference. So how did people use power in a later stage in history? And what can that tell us about the period I'm actually studying now? I think history never repeats itself, but we can use comparisons as to weigh different epochs against one another. And I think the conclusions drawn from these comparisons can really be interesting and important.
Yeah, do you perhaps see reflections of today's politics, of the strategies that you were seeing, that we are seeing at work today, communicated through different kinds of media, communication channels? Do you see some resemblance there with what these politicians or these Roman military men or powerful men did towards or for like empowering their position? Is there something that we can get a deeper insight into those kind of attitudes towards society?
I think in general differences are more outspoken than similarities, because we are now living in a fundamentally different society based on bureaucracy, parliamentary democracy, etc. And back then it was a society based on patronage with a huge inequality. So I don't think like direct parallels can be drawn. But on the other hand, there are some interesting similarities sometimes. When you see how elites lobby at the imperial court to defend their economic interests, one is sometimes surprised by the similarity with contemporary practices. So for instance, in my PhD dissertation, I researched the associations of athletes and artists in the Roman Empire. And there it is very clear that these associations managed to lobby for extensive economic privileges and were defending their financial interests. And I think this general observation of powerful associations or companies like using political power to defend their economic position, I think you cannot deny that this still happens today. So I think it remains useful to draw comparisons, even if we have to be careful and be aware of the fundamental differences too.
I think we sort of touched on it before about how classics or history is perceived by society. I'm wondering if you can maybe talk a little bit about maybe how we as academics or as historians, classicists, can maybe communicate or improve or contribute to our societies, if you have any ideas of sort of what the relationship is and maybe ways that we can build on that and contribute more broadly.
I will sound quite harsh here. I'm hard on academia here. Not classics in particular, but academia in general. I think academia has a problem. There is a big gap between academia and the rest of society. This ivory tower, it's a reality. Academia is a closed circuit, if I may call it that. Because when we want to continue an academic career, pursue an academic career and publish, we publish in journals that are not accessible to a broader public. And this is a major problem. So initiatives have been taken to bridge the gap, but I think it remains only window dressing. I think we have to do a lot more. Academia has a public role, and we shouldn't forget that. We are being funded with public money, but the results of our research disappear behind a paywall. I think this should be changed. And many people say the same, but still nothing happens. And I think it's very frustrating. And I think there is so much more we could do. I experienced the gap myself. I'm working now on a secondary school book. I confess I couldn't leave the world of secondary education entirely behind. So I'm cooperating to a school book for history in secondary schools. And I'm the only academic there. I'm a big exception. Like academics in general don't really cooperate to writing these school texts because they have nothing to gain from that. It is not being rewarded when writing an application, or not really rewarded. And because of this, like new insights, new academic insights often have a hard way finding their way to new textbooks. It's a big problem. So in my perfect world, a team of textbook writers should be composed of both teachers and researchers, but this is not the case. I'm the only one in the writing team with access to academic literature. I have a code with which to access JSTOR. My colleagues don't. So I find that perplexing.
No, I think you're absolutely right. Like, not only about the closed circuit, the fact that, of course, like we're paid from taxpayers, but nothing we do is visible to them. And also, I think, especially within European funding, and also in the UK when I was there, there is this sort of push lately that you do have to engage with the public. You know, there's this sort of stress on impact, and everyone says that we need to do it. And of course, now in applications, everyone needs to say, oh, this is how I'm going to do it. But I do think that we as academics haven't quite internalized, one, how important it is, and two, how much time you have to devote to it. Because of course, everyone now says, okay, I'll do a blog, or I'll do this outreach thing. But I don't think it's sort of recognized that it has to be more than just an extra on the side. We have to sort of embed this in our profession, just like teaching and publishing is part of our profession. This has to become a central part of our profession, not just an extra thing you do in your own time. So I think you're right about this closed circuit.
The problem is that this outreach or science communication, it remains an extra, as you said. It's not essential. What is being evaluated is your publications in top class journals. So I think in my perfect world, you are being evaluated on the basis both publications, but also this science communication and your teaching and your social role as an academic. And also many people say, okay, I will communicate to the broader public by writing blog posts. But how many people will read this?
Precisely.
I think academics should engage more with, for instance, Wikipedia. For many people, Wikipedia is the prime source of information, for most people, I guess. Because the first class journals, they are not accessible. And many academics complain about Wikipedia because the quality is not as good as real scientific publications. But then I think, okay, make it better. Let us contribute to Wikipedia and make it better. Why not make students rewrite or write Wikipedia pages and as an exercise? Professors in general, I think, do not really contribute to Wikipedia because, again, it is not rewarded. But I think if many professors would write on Wikipedia, it would become better. And research would be more broadly disseminated to a larger public. So I think bridging the gap between academia and the rest of society remains an important challenge.
Yeah, indeed. It's one of the main issues that it's, as you both have mentioned, it is not really a core activity of what an academic has to do today. And if he or she is not rewarded for actively contributing to society, then it will always remain something like, when I have a little bit more time, when I can spend some time on this, and then perhaps I will do this, and then perhaps I can do that. But I really think indeed it has to become a core activity of what an academic has to do in his daily research work. Another aspect that perhaps is interesting to touch on is I know a lot of persons inside academia that struggle also with the when you talk about transition or keeping the balance between the different aspects of your work or your life, is the balance between personal and private life and life in academia. A lot of people tend to spend most of their time, maybe too much time, on their work. So I was wondering, how do you perceive that with having worked also outside academia, I suspect you have another perspective on this, perhaps a more healthier perspective sometimes. So how do you try to find that balance between personal and work life?
A lot of things changed for me when I became a father. In 2019, my daughter was born, and this really changed my perspective. When writing my PhD dissertation, I could work until late in the evening. There's no problem for me, but now it's just not possible to do that. And I take my role as a father really seriously. I really want to spend enough time with my daughter. I want to be there for her and contribute to her education and upbringing. I find that an essential goal in my life. So I'm guarding this work-life balance better, I think. I still do what needs to be done, of course, and sometimes I work in the evening when it's necessary, when something has to be finished. But in general, I try to keep the balance, yes, and I don't want to be an absent dad, absolutely not.
I can understand that completely. I find that a very healthy and also a fresh attitude that you don't hear that often in academia. Yeah. And I think it's very, very valuable that you mentioned this kind of vision towards your work and towards your personal life. Yeah, absolutely.
And I also know that this may also finish my academic career, because going international is so important. So, because there are not many job opportunities in this small country, so most people go abroad when they want to finish their academic career, and I won't do that. I've been abroad, I had my international experience, and I want my daughter to grow up near her family and friends, so I won't take her to Germany or the Netherlands or England. I think being close to family, her grandparents, her aunts, uncles, it's so important, and I don't want to force her growing up somewhere else. I don't think it's a disaster either, but I have made that choice. And if that means that my academic career will end, then it will be like that. But my daughter's future has a priority, I think. And that's also maybe one point of criticism towards academia nowadays: to be a perfect young scholar, you shouldn't have roots. You should be able to go anywhere in the world to find new jobs, new postdocs, new whatever. You should be highly mobile. But once you become a parent, your options become limited. I don't know if it could be different. I think international experience is still extremely valuable, but there are limits.
Yeah, I totally agree with what you say. I think one thing that I'm happy about, that some of these funding bodies for young academics are at least, some of them, not all of them certainly, some of them seem to be noticing the problem with mobility and what that means for your family. So for example, the external funding I have at Ghent, my partner could come with me at the beginning, and I got a little bit more money so that he could come with me and have time to look for a job. And there are some of these schemes where, you know, the funders understand that, okay, if you have to drag your family around, they need to give you more money so that your family can find roots. But it doesn't really take away the problem that also as young academics, we're expected to be mobile for the first 10 years of our career, which is just, it's a lot to ask for somebody with a partner who wants to have children, who wants to put down their roots. It's hard enough, even if you're alone, but certainly if you're trying to build a life, it's also, definitely a problem in our field.
Yeah, I think it asks for a fundamental change in academic mentality, because we're indeed often complaining and rightfully so complaining about the fact that we need to go abroad, we need to publish as many articles as we can, we need to be mobile, we need to be flexible, don't have any roots, and try to build our careers from bits and patches into some kind of consistent track record. But I think also that changing that kind of mentality starts with ourselves, starts with actually our generation of younger scholars that is finding his way or its way into this world of academia. And it's also for us to say, well, we don't actually pursue all the time this kind of academic life, this kind of academic world. It should also be possible to find some kind of a midway in that kind of thinking. So I think there is also an important active role there for academia and maybe also for the field of classics. And I think in this way, we can also contribute not only to society or outside academia, but also to the discipline or the sector, the field itself.
I must say, coming to the Belgian system, and I think I may have talked to both of you individually about this, and maybe Ghent University is special, but something that I must say that I think is really great about Ghent University is it seems at least that there's a real desire that the people who are employed at this university have a good work-life balance, like much more than in any institution I've been in before. And something that I realized when I came here is that in the summer, when a person at Ghent University has an out of office reply, it means they're out of office, and you know, it's okay to take a vacation and not answer your email. And so I think I'd never experienced before. So I must say, I think at least Ghent University is going in the right direction of trying to support people to have a healthy balance and to take the time off. And maybe it'll just get better in the future if we keep pushing for it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I experienced the same. So this is not just to please my employer, but it's true. I think Ghent is working towards a better work-life balance. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I feel very, very lucky in a way, which also is just terrible to think that's such a unique, novel thing that you're allowed to take a vacation. But but yeah.
Maybe a nice question to conclude the interview of today. We've talked already a little bit about how do you think about your past experiences and how this may influence your future endeavors. But if you would have to say now, how do you see your future? And if it wouldn't be really in academia, or perhaps more geared towards a secondary teaching, or you ideally like to find a middle way between those kind of activities. How do you envision your future?
That's a typical question when you apply for a new job. So I find it honestly really hard to answer that, because I try so much to live in the past. And yeah, and future can offer so many unexpected things. So if you allow me, I won't give a real answer to that question. I'll see what comes. I cannot predict what will come. I'm sure something will cross my way, which is entirely unexpected and which may lead me to something else entirely. So I won't give a satisfying answer, but I will do what I can to keep working in academia. And if that fails, I will probably go back to secondary education, and with no hard feelings. But because as I told you before, these are two passions which are of the same worth to me. So I'll be just as happy, I think, as a history teacher than as a researcher. So I think one of these two directions will open themselves up for me. And I don't know which of the two will prove to be right, but the future will show.
I think that's a beautiful answer, and perhaps also the perfect antidote for a society that has become perhaps too much familiar with the idea of the wish to control every step in our life. So I think that you actually gave the perfect answer. So thank you, Bram, for this nice interview, and also a big thanks to our listeners. In our next episode, we will talk with Adeline Hoffling from the Department of Archaeology. Until then.